Will Rogers, Ambassador of Goodwill, Prince of Wit and Wisdom, Chapter 11. On the Speaker's Platform. Will Rogers violated every known rule of rhetoric and oratory, but he was in demand everywhere as an after-dinner speaker, and fortunate was the diner who was present when he delivered one of his masterpieces. The lecture platform also provided his forte, and he laughingly referred to his one-man shows, which sometimes ran hours beyond the time for closing, as concerts. The greatest personal satisfaction I ever got was from my concerts, Will once declared. That was the hardest work, but it was the most gratifying. When you're out on the stage with no one to help you. The first season, I used a quartet. The second season, I was alone. People said you couldn't hold an audience 2 hours alone with no material but your own. But it worked, and that's much more gratifying than playing in a picture. Personally gratifying, I mean. After concerts, I'd put stage plays. The satisfaction the pictures give you is of covering a great territory almost without effort. Seems unbelievable that you can make a picture, and in no time at all, it circles the globe. Talking once on the radio where there is no audience to see how your gags are going is harder than doing 10 performances of a stage play or making a whole picture. On the lecture tour. When the subject of going on a lecture tour was first broached by Rogers, he thought someone was trying to have fun with him. Charles L. Wagner, who conceived the idea, wrote to the humorist and offered a contract for $30,000 a month. Rogers paid no attention to it. A week later, Wagner was standing on Broadway with a friend when Will walked by. Wagner told the friend how he had written to Rogers and received no reply. Wagner's companion said he knew Rogers and volunteered to find out what the comedian thought of the lecture proposition. "Well, I'll be darned," said Will when he was asked about it. "I received a letter like that, but I thought some of the boys at the Friars Club was kidding me. You know, they got a bartender up there named Charlie Wagner." He toured the United States under the direction of Wagner and packed him in night after night. He explained at every stop that he had no message and was not an ambassador. At New Orleans, he was told of a plan to build a bridge over the mighty Mississippi River, and he referred to it in his concert. The audience applauded, but as the last hand clap died away, he whipped over, "You told Mark Twain that, too." Will was extremely proud of the fact that his lectures were given all sorts of conditions. "I had a clean show," he said, "and when we were booked into the church, I didn't have to change a line of the patter, only had to cut out some of the rope stuff." At Kansas City on the eve of the Republican convention, he gave his concert for charity in a theater that filled to capacity 2 hours before he stepped out on the stage. Police had to be called out to control the great crowds outside that clamored to be admitted. Joe Laurie, a famous vaudeville and musical comedy star and a close friend of Will Rogers, told of meeting the comedian in Philadelphia where the humorist presented one of his lectures before an audience that included the most exclusive of Quaker City society. After the performance, Rogers declined all the invitations that were pressed upon him to visit the socially elect in their homes. Instead, Lowry said, he came over to my hotel room and threw himself on the bed. The two of us talked until nearly 4 o'clock in the morning. He had just played in Oklahoma City a short time before, and he told me of the tremendous kick he got out of playing in his home state. The lecture was given in the convention hall, and Rogers described how the people drove there in automobiles and mule carts. Rogers started that show, Lowry continued, at 8:30 p.m., and he finished at 11:30 p.m., but the people refused to go home, so he started in again and talked until 1:30 a.m. "Tears came to his eyes," said Lowry, when he told how a group of girls presented him with garlands of flowers and some old Indian woman gave him a large, gaily colored vase. There were many stories told about Rogers refusing to wear a dinner coat at formal affairs, but according to Lowry, he blossomed out in a tuxedo the night the Friars Club gave a dinner to Will Hayes, Judge Kennesaw Mountain Landis, and Augustus Thomas, the three Caesars of motion pictures, baseball, and the stage, respectively. It was cut to resemble his blue suit, however, and he frequently joked about it. "I'm getting to be like a fireman," he said. "Every time I hear the word dinner, I slide into my dinner clothes and dash off to attend it." Speech at Friars Club, a classic. It was as an after-dinner speaker that Will Rogers adopted his intimate type of address that he did not use at other places. The Friars were noted for the outstanding notables that graced their festive boards, and whenever Rogers could get to New York, he was certain to be called upon to speak, and he always stole the show away from the guest of honor. The night of the Hayes-Landis-Thomas dinner, he delivered the following classic. There is an awful lot of theatrical managers in the room tonight, and they know what it is, after years of experience, to miscast an act. If ever there was in the history of any theatrical dinners or anything that anybody was miscast in, I'm him. I haven't even got the part dressed right. I don't have to tell you that I'm out of place here. I have felt it more than you do out there because I knew that I didn't belong. I worked over at our club, at the Friars, at a few little Bush League dinners that we have had, and that was all right, and that was over there. And we were feeding people that really needed it. But I came over here tonight in this big league affair, and I knew that I didn't belong. All of my friends sitting around here will tell you that. During the entire evening, I was afraid to eat. I was hungry, I admit that. Actors usually are. But I couldn't eat because I knew that when I got up to speak, I would be liable to boot one. The point I'm trying to make is that I didn't eat here tonight, and if I am rotten, I don't owe you anything. And they told me, Will, we're going to give a big dinner, and we're going to entertain the three biggest men of the three biggest amusement industries in the world, and we have conferred quite an honor on you. We are going to let you in, and you are going to speak on the man that represents the biggest industry. I started into work. I read everything that I could pertaining to it, but I didn't ask who the man was because it didn't make any difference to me who the man was. The industry which you represented was so vast that it dwarfed the man and didn't make any difference who he was. I didn't care. It was what he represented, and I didn't even ask. I brought to this hotel here tonight a 15 or 20 minute speech, 15 without laughs and 20 with laughs. As I came in from the outside there, I met one of these gentlemen, and he says to me, I see, Will, that you're giving us some stuff on Hayes. I said, what Hayes? And he said, Will Hayes. He's the man, Will Hayes of the movies. Well, sir, I give you my word that in all of my little career in New York here, since I arrived with that carpet bag, that I was never more upset because you could have knocked me out with a feather. There, I'd gone 2 whole weeks after they told me that it was the biggest amusement business in the world. I had gone home and I prepared this address on bootlegging. Jibes at the movie industry. I am going to admit to you folks that with all of my little experience on the stage, I was struck, and I am struck yet because, in comparison, you know that I got all of this stuff on a wonderful industry, and to then find out that you have got to drop right down to moving pictures? Well, it is a terrible setback, you know, to have to come down from a national commodity and talk about a 10-cent cereal. Why, even cornflakes, which is the lowest form of cereal in the world, and they sell for 20 cents. And just think that I have to come here and tell you about this 10-cent industry. It's not fair, because you know bootlegging is an honor. There is something to it. I mean, it means something. You're selling a staple, something that is good today. But what are the movies? Only a lot of storms with different names to them. You can't do that. That don't go. The movies is something that is made for children, while bootlegging is made for men. You know it means something. I am really handicapped here tonight because now you take the liquor industry with one man. Why, if he takes 2 drinks of scotch or something like that, 2 drinks of scotch commands more respect than all of the hair oil of a Valentino or the toothpaste of a Fairbanks. You would consider a successful hooch man of more reputation than all the blood and sand and Robin Hoods combined. But getting right down to it, take just 1 quart of scotch that has to be sent to this country by way of Canada, and it has been diluted and sold and resold in more towns than Chaplin has been the kid in. And it is unfair to ask a man to defend an industry that winds around and around and gets nowhere. But then you say, that is all right. You are not supposed to talk about the industry. What you're supposed to talk about is the man that represents the industry. Well, there he is. Just look at him. That little bird. What are you going to say about him? I don't know. I have known him for years, and on account of that, I shouldn't have been asked to speak for him. From now on, I will have to make up my stuff as I go along, and it is almost as hard to think about something that I can say about him as it is about the industry he represents. There is just one thing that is a good sign tonight about this dinner. When I found that I am to defend and represent this man, I made up my mind that I am not going to back down. If I have to try to defend him, I am going to do it to the best of my ability, and the only thing that helps me out is this, that as low as his industry stands below that of bootlegging, yet so high does it stand above these two other birds represented here. Takes a fling at Landis. Take this man Landis, this little glorified rounder thing that has come here with this thing baseball. What is baseball? Baseball is not an industry, and as the Yankees play it, it is not even a game. It doesn't mean anything. Well, he comes from the bench. He is the only man in the history of the world that ever jumped from the bench into the grandstand. Most players go from the bench into the grandstand. I happened to be up there one evening when the sun was shining, about 3 o'clock on a certain afternoon over Coogan's Bluff, and the game was called on account of darkness. And I thought at that time, when those 10,000 people were howling around this box, that his next jump would be from box to the scaffold. I am only trying to prove my case with my man, with my little client. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm only trying to prove to you that the intelligence of a baseball audience is even lower than the movies. And they thought he called the game. Now, what do you think of that? If you can beat that, well, that shows the degree of intelligence to which his industry caters. The umpire called the game, naturally. Now, I will say this for the baseball fan. A baseball fan is not supposed to know much, but he does know night from day. And if this man did not know enough to appoint an umpire that knows light from dark, how is the umpire going to tell a ball from a strike? Now, they caught on to that. You say that that was about the lowest form of intelligence that there is, as demonstrated by the baseball, but it is not. Absolutely, and they have gathered another industry here tonight, which is even lower than that, even worse than the others. We have tonight another one that came in years ago in Rome and has been in all of the ancient cities, London, Oklahoma City, all of the old towns. In these, there used to be a bunch of people who went about the streets making faces, and the people would throw them bouquets. Busking, they called it. Busking. They were buffoons, mountebanks. It didn't mean anything. And somebody conceived the idea of taking these people in off the street and putting them in a theater and, through charity, putting a roof over their heads. I think that it was Marcus Lowe that built the first one. He brought them into the theater. To give you an idea of the intelligence that is exemplified, represented in one of these temples of art. Well, I wandered into one day, and the first thing that comes out on the stage and greets me is a rough, uncouth person with no refinement, no intelligence, with not even a half regard for the English language. Well, gentlemen, evidently this individual had been raised close to a livery stable, and he comes up on the stage with a lot of ropes and jumps back and forth through these ropes like a monkey or something. His remarks were of the same simian variety, and chewing about something like a cow or a cud. Now, absolutely, after seeing this, gentlemen, you know a man of my refinement, I say absolutely that it was repulsive to me, and now that is one of the gentlemen that Mr. Thomas represents in his industry. Mr. Landis says that is fine, as he says when Babe Ruth goes all around the country and plays baseball. He says, I'm going to set him down for 40 days. But now it comes down to Mr. Hopper running around here, and he should be made to live with the same wife for 40 days. And now tonight, we get these gentlemen together at this big dinner. When this big dinner of the Friars was first talked about, they asked, who is Landis? Well, he was a judge. Where? He was a judge out in Chicago. They said, right away, the theatrical people would say, well, that will never do. New York won't stand for a Chicago product. But that was put out because Judge Landis was not known. That is, here in theatrical circles, he is only known in baseball and the Standard Oil. Then it comes down to Will Hayes. What about Will Hayes? And somebody says, we can't give a dinner to Will Hayes. Will Hayes is a Republican. And he says, even if we got all the four Republicans in New York, the dinner wouldn't pay. Pokes fun at Augustus Thomas. But how about Thomas? He's the head of the theater, and he's a playwright. Well, they says, a lot of the members of the Friars, in fact, all of us, has written plays. And that's no reason just because Thomas has been unfortunate enough to have some of them produced. That is no reason we should have him a dinner. So it came down to finally the idea that we can't get a dinner at $10 a plate for these men. How about making it $3.33 a piece and having them all together and having one? So the idea appealed to the spirit of the Friars. And so we've got them here tonight, the biggest thing that they've ever held. We have them here tonight, 3-1, you know, the big 3-1. And if any of you feel prominent enough tonight, and we'll get two other friends together, we'll have a dinner with you. Now, gentlemen, in closing, I want to say now, my man, I'm here to defend him with the best that I have got in me. And my little man that is sitting there, now, mind you, in stature, while I might say he is a Ford in stature, but in intelligence, mind you, in intellect, he is really a Dodge. Now, before he sold his soul into this sinful screen, well, he merged his manhood into the murderous movies. And this man was respected in the community. He was a man who was held very high. But now he is in the screen. He is in the movies, which, as I would say, is the buttonhole end of the amusement business. Here is a man now that used to be Postmaster General of the United States, and he had the charge of all the letters which passed between each and every one of us and everyone in the United States, and he would have gotten that appointment with this wonderful position much sooner with the movies if they had sent it by telegram, but they sent the announcement by mail. When he got his appointment, he said, Warren, what will I do? And Warren says, well, how much is it at? And Will says, $150,000. And Warren says, go on in, Will. And if you see anything good, let me know, and I'll come in with you. The Republicans promised the country prosperity, but up to now, Hayes is the only one that has got any of it. There are two others of these Hayes boys. There was Archbishop and Will. I learned from my good and my dear friend, Father Duffy, that Archbishop Hayes is soon to be made a cardinal. Well, Will had 150. I tell you, these Hayes boys are doing great. He absolutely was responsible for more than any other man in the United States for electing Warren G. Harding president. Will Hayes took an unknown man from a front porch at Marion to the stage door of the White House, and he started him in there. He is the friend and confidential advisor of two presidents of the United States, and one was the greatest one which we have ever heard of, Theodore Roosevelt, and one, Mr. Harding. I know these things to be a fact because the most cherished thing in my life was meeting these two gentlemen, Mr. Roosevelt and Mr. Harding, and Will Hayes was the one who took me in and introduced me to both of them. And the reason I know he is great is that he didn't knock either of them, and he didn't knock at the door. He just went in. Now, I want to say that my little man, he is the confidential friend, personal advisor, and right-hand man of not only two presidents, but he was feared and respected by another for 8 years. And in the words of our illustrious abbot, George M. Cohen, all I can say about him is that he is a great little guy. Rogers takes up Al Smith. Will Collier was Toastmaster the night the Friars gave a dinner to their fellow member Al Smith, governor of New York State and later Democratic nominee for president. Collier introduced Rogers as follows. I present my old friend and fellow actor with the toughest spot on the bill. This guy must be a great bird, said Will Rogers. If he is not a great bird, we have the greatest conglomeration of liars ever gathered together on the Lord's earth. Some of it that we have heard here were lies, and the chances are a great deal of it were lies, because no man could live and be that good and great. Not in New York. He couldn't, and not in politics. So I am one of the speakers that will not sell my pride and stand up here and lie for a mere dinner. They are better educated than I am, the speakers who have preceded me, but they haven't got any more honor than I have, so I will not sell myself for a mere meal. As I say, I want to take up Mr. Smith. I am glad that none of them discovered him under the shade of the Brooklyn Bridge. I want to find him there. It seems that they didn't discover him until after he had a change of shirts when he got up in political life. I found him when South Street and Oliver Street was North America to him. And if a man ever left that neighborhood and go as far north as 14th Street, he was a globetrotter. He was born under the shadow of Brooklyn Bridge. He saw Brooklyn Bridge in his youth. He saw them build Brooklyn Bridge. And Brooklyn Bridge is the greatest ad that Brooklyn ever had. If some man had accidentally named that bridge New York Bridge, there never would have been any Brooklyn. As a youth, he grew up there. The nearest place was the firehouse. Fire Engine Company number 32, John Binns, captain. Am I right? Yes, sir. He grew up there. The first 10 years of his life he spent. In those days, they used horses with fire engines. The first 10 years of his life, he spent chasing after the fire wagon, running to fires. He got so adept at it that he could tell by the smell of the smoke whose house was burning. At the age of 11, somebody invented a fireproof house, and he lost his job. At 12, he learned elocution. He learned elocution and also learned to dive off the docks in the East River. The last accomplishment was far more beneficial. Through running to these fires is where he got the running experience for some 20 political races. He is the only man in public life that will never run for an office. He never gave up the one that he was holding to run for another one. He always held one. When he was running for the presidential nomination, he was still governor. He always had the ace in the hole. There was no open weeks in his career. At the age of 13, his father died and left him the sole support of his mother and sister. His father was a truckman, had his team of horses, and worked very hard, and left this young boy to support the family. Now, Al could have taken up the trucking business in those days, but the horses would not listen to his elocution. So we got a job in the Fulton Fish Market. Fish are not very discriminating in what is said in their presence. Fish are the only things in the world, perhaps, that will listen to you recite. And he worked there for years. He worked in this fish market for 7 years. At the end of 4 years, he worked there 7 years, but at the end of 4 years, as the recitations grew longer than live fish, had him transferred to the dead fish department. Working in this fish market led him into his political career, and he has been talking to fish ever since. Last summer in Madison Square Garden was gathered, I suppose, the greatest collection of fish in the annals of this country. In that collection last summer in Madison Square Garden at the gathering, there were suckers from the south, and there were bloaters from the west, there were bullheads from the north, and there were eels from the east. And to show you it was a fish collection, they had to hold the convention in a swimming pool, and every one of them that got up to make a speech was a big-mouth bass. At the age of 18, Al was given a silver medal for debating. That is the only year's work he ever lost. The next year, he was polishing his medal. During the time he tried to keep this medal from tarnishing, he took an amateur theatricals, which is the lowest brand of theatricals in the world. It is bad enough to be a ham, but when you are a ham for nothing, it is terrible. Al Smith's courtship. He fell in love with a girl, Catherine Dunn, and odd to say, he is still in love with her. He fell in love with a girl whose family was Irish. People in those days fell in love with ones of their own nationality. When the Dunns heard that Al, the actor for nothing, was snooping around, they moved to the Bronx, thinking they would be done with Al. But they didn't know our Al. And by the way, when the Dunns moved to the Bronx, they were the first and the last Irish family that ever went there. Al heard about the Bronx, and on account of training for the theatrical career, he walked up there. And when he got to the Bronx, they had to give him the girl to get rid of him. He stayed around there, and they practically sacrificed Catherine to keep from feeding Al. But before giving the girl over in marriage to Al, they disapproved of his acting business. So he had them come and see him in one of his plays, The Shogun. They came to see Al play, and after they saw him acting, they withdrew their objections on that account. They said, "Daughter, we were wrong. Your sweetheart is not an actor." The Dunns at that time thought that acting was about the lowest profession that there was, naturally, and they had never thought of a politician. He took his young bride back down where they were raised, down on, well, they got high-toned and moved to Oliver Street. That was the Palm Beach of its time. And they moved to Oliver Street, and Al Smith has always lived down there with these people. In the first days, it was all Irish, and it was all Irish that lived in the neighborhood. The Jews came along and raised the rent, and the Irish had to get out. The Jews only stayed there 2 or 3 years, and they had made enough to immigrate north. In the early days, our forefathers went across the plains in a covered wagon, but due to Mayor Hyland and the 5-cent fare, they immigrated to the Bronx for a nickel. Then in came the Wops in this very district. The Wops stayed in there a while, and along come the Greeks and run them out. So now he is living down there among the Greeks in his same old neighborhood because he figures that a Greek vote is just as much as an Irish vote. It doesn't make any difference whose vote it is. They go to the polls and vote for Al Smith, and they vote for him for anything. They put down Al Smith for everything from president down to alderman or whatever it might be. They know he's running for something, and they're going to get him. You have a great collection of people here in this hall tonight, all the Irish and Jewish people. The Irish are here to lord it over their other fellows, the Irish nationality, you know. They are here to boast that Al is one of them. The Jews are here, you know, to stand in with him so he'll cut the income tax down. So they had to send out and get a lone Protestant to come in, the only Protestant in the hall who had nerve to tell the truth about it. Now, I want to tell you what the people of New York think of Al Smith. As I spoke of a while ago, during this epidemic of Democratic hydrophobia, which prevailed in Madison Square Garden last summer and through the biggest part of last year, it was my misfortune to have to report that affair. I used to have to go down there every day from the hotel. I live right here in this hotel. I had to rush down there to cover that convention. And on account of this old homely mug and because of my working in pictures and a little of everything trying to make a living, I am known by most of the taxi drivers and cops in this town. None of the good people know me, but all of these fellows know me by sight. When I would come out of that convention hall and start up the theater to work a matinee, at the last minute I would have a big cop. He would not have to be Irish or any other nationality. He would just rush up to me. "How was the last vote?" There would be a tremor in his voice when he would ask me, "How was the last vote? Are they still giving him the vote?" And I would say, "Yes, he's got a chance." I says, "Well, I think he has. He is going all right, fine." And I would get into a taxi cab, and the driver was the toughest mug in the world, whom you would not think knew whether our president was elected or the job was hereditary. And before he would start, he would turn to me and say, "How is Al doing? Are they going to beat him? How is he doing?" Popularity with Al Smith. Everywhere you would go, when I would come into the theater, the minute I would rush into the stage door, every stagehand would rush up and say, "How is the vote? Is Al gaining? Do you think? Those crooks aren't going to beat him. Do you think?" Every one of them. The manager of the theater would come back and want to know how everything was. He would say, "You were down there, and you talked to those delegates. How is he doing?" And I would say, "Well, I think everything is all right. It looks like he's holding his own fine." I have seen news kids on the street where the headlines came out that he had lost in the vote, absolutely with no heart to sell their papers, if he was not ahead. That is the man I am speaking about right here tonight. Those are just the things I have seen in those times. I have come into this hotel, and the elevator boys would ask me before they would start the elevator, "How is the vote? What do you think? Ain't they going to nominate him? Gee, everybody wants him." I would go down to the barbershop where every nationality is employed, and the same thing prevailed. I talked with the delegates from all over the West and everywhere, and they said, "What manner of man is this, Al Smith, that everybody's so crazy about him? What sort of fellow is he?" I said, "I don't know. You've got to meet him, that is all. To really know him, and these people meet him, and they do know him. I'll bet you that during that convention, you could have called for a draft of men to give up their lives for this nomination, and you would have found as many would have done it as will go to the next war." That is what they thought of him. Now, you can't get that kind of admiration on nothing. You have to do something to have people as cuckoo as that about you, especially if you have gone 23 years. He has 23 years of public service. Now, you cannot get it. You must have done something in all of that time, because while he might fool us Christians that long, you Jews would have gotten wise in 2 years. Let me tell you something. This goes with all of the Tammany Hall organization here and all. Al Smith don't owe New York one thing. Al Smith don't owe Tammany Hall one thing. Tammany Hall, as far as national officers are concerned, is a detriment and was a detriment to Al Smith. You know as well as I do that outside of Tammany Hall, whether it is unearned or not, but outside of that, you know that the people are a little leery of Tammany Hall, and that is not kidding you either. They are leery of you birds outside of New York. New York was not of any advantage to him because the people in the other states say, "Ah, New York, we will give them nothing." So he had to fight in the face of all of that, and so Al Smith has done more for Tammany Hall than Tammany Hall has ever done for Al Smith. He is the first big public official you ever had here. Since that convention came off, and with all of the friends that he made through it, he is the first man in public life from Tammany Hall that the rest of the United States today will trust. That is not Tammany Hall's fault. It is not New York or anything. You try to do the best you could for him. That is because they know him better, and they know him now. They know he is honest. They know he is square. And no matter, I don't care, you can talk to a Republican. He might not be for him. He might be a rabid Republican. And if you are a Republican, you are rabid. But if you talk about him, everyone will admit that Smith is on the level. And I do not care whether he is for him politically or not. He will admit that Smith is on the level. He is a square guy.